Welcome to Building a Powerful Movement in the United States. On today's show, we're going to start out with Chris Hedges. A couple weeks ago, a reporter ran into Chris Hedges at the Occupy Times Square demonstration. The encounter gave Hedges the opportunity to summarize his thoughts on the importance of the Occupy movement for this country and the world. It also allowed him to express his own personal feelings about the movement. So shortly, we'll hear from an emotional Chris Hedges. After that, we'll hear from economist Michael Hudson. Michael Hudson will be speaking at a teach-in at Occupy Los Angeles on Saturday, along with William K. Black and Robert Scheer. As you'll hear, economists, like other intellectuals, understand that the movement is not interested in specific public policy proposals at this moment. So how to get a thinker like Michael Hudson to express his vision for an alternate economy in the United States? I posit this hypothetical question to Michael Hudson. What if, in January 2013, you find yourself as the chief economic advisor to the President of the United States? How would you propose reorganizing the American economy? Hudson, who was the chief economic advisor to Denis Kucinich's 2008 presidential campaign, lays it all out. After that, we'll hear from Melisa Figueroa, who participated in yesterday's Oakland general strike. We'll hear Melisa's reflections both on the day and also on the events that broke late last night, when a group of demonstrators who were occupying a previously unoccupied building had an encounter with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. But first, let's hear from Chris Hedges.
I'm Chris Hedges. I'm a writer. I write books. I spent 20 years overseas as a war correspondent. Came back and realized that corporations had carried out a coup d'etat in my country. And I've been fighting back, although not as effectively as you guys. Well, I've covered movements. I covered all of the revolutions in Eastern Europe. I covered the street demonstrations that brought down Milosevic. I've covered the both of the Palestinian intifadas. And once movements like this start and articulate a fundamental truth about the society that they live in and expose the repression, the mendacity, the corruption, and the decay of the structures of power, then they have a kind of centrifugal force. You never know where they're going. I was with the leaders of the movement, the opposition movement in East Germany in Leipzig on the afternoon of November 9th, 1989, and they said that perhaps within a year there would be free passage back and forth across the Berlin Wall. In a few hours, the Berlin Wall didn't exist. What happens is, in all of these movements, this was true in Prague as well, is that the foot soldiers of the elite, the blue uniform police, the mechanisms of control finally don't want to impede the movement. And at that point, the power elite is left defenseless. So where is it going? No one knows. Even the people most intimately involved in the organization don't know. All of these movements take on a kind of life and color that is in some ways finally mysterious. The only thing I can say, having been in the middle of similar movements, is that this one is real, and this one could take them all down.
You had to advise.
Well, let me first say I learned a lot more from the people who are occupying than my critique of the corporate state, I think, coalesces with the critique that many people in Occupy Wall Street have. But I never wrote in any of my books about how to bring them down. This whole non-hierarchical structure is really brilliant. And I didn't have a clue. Because they can't destroy the movement like that. The fact that you rotate people through positions of leadership, and the fact that you're completely transparent, the fact that you realize that you've clearly been provoked. I mean, Anthony Bologna was trying to provoke people in that crowd because they want windows smashed. What, they know how to handle that. They don't know how to handle this. This is driving them insane. And the fact is that I can guarantee you that huge segments of those blue uniform police sympathize with everything that you're doing. And that is the way you can shatter the manacles of control that have been placed on the country by the corporate state. And that's what scares them. I mean, the most aggressive figures in the crowds are these white-shirted... Always remember that you only have to deal with them, you know, once in a while. These poor uniformed cops got to deal with them every day. I think the movement's really, 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 really smart, really astute, and I don't really think I have much to teach it at all. I don't think there's any danger of this movement being seduced or co-opted by MoveOn.org, which is a reprehensible organization, or the Democratic Party or anyone else, or the Teamsters. The fact is, what you've done what they have not done, which is fight back. And because you've fought back, they've been exposed for who they are, i.e. the leaders of this group. That's why they're running to you and attempting to restore what little shredded credibility they have left. You know, I'm a visitor. I come and go. But I don't sense that there's any danger. I think the sort of political consciousness of this group is so high that they see through all of these figures who show up the park. I mean, I was there when Patterson showed up, Charlie Rangel showed up. I mean, it's sort of almost sad in a way, because the fact is they have offered nothing, done nothing, except, of course, Mao, this empty rhetoric, this kind of feel-your-pain language while betraying the very people they purportedly represent. So I don't think there's any danger of this movement being co-opted at all. I think that you know, even with the Teamsters, the union bosses, and these union bosses are pulling down five times what the rank and file is pulling down, they've done nothing for unions except basically barter away their benefits and rights. And in fact, you know, the union bosses have to get down here because otherwise they're going to lose their rank and file. That's why you're seeing groups like MoveOn or Teamsters coming down here, because you do what their leadership has not done, which is stand up. And let me just say something. I wasn't here Friday morning. For me, I got kids. And it's not about me anymore. It's about the next generation. It's about my children's generation. And I think my passion for what you're doing, and I would even use the word love, comes from the fact that I look at you as fighting on behalf of, like, my little three-year-old. And when I, on Friday morning, of course I was up to find out what happened, and I did what I do now, which is start crying. God bless you all.
Louder!
We are the
99%! The world is watching!
We are the 99%!
Louder!
I'm joined now by Michael Hudson. Michael Hudson is a distinguished research professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and he is also president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you very much.
Now, Michael Hudson is going to be addressing Occupy LA, or is scheduled to be addressing Occupy LA, as part of a teach-in that includes William Black, and Robert Scheer will be moderating the panel that Michael will be on this weekend. And Michael, what I want to talk to you about, because I'm familiar with your work, and I know that you are a big picture economic thinker, and as you look at this movement, this is definitely a movement that is asking the big questions about the organization of the global economy and the national economy. What would you say if Michael Hudson right now were speaking to the movement at large and the ideas about reorganizing a contemporary, high-tech, industrial, modern economy in a way that would produce more social and economic justice?
Well, there's something very interesting that makes it almost like what used to be called the Great Awakening period in America. I think we have to take a step back and I think talk about tactics to some extent. The basic problem that everybody has right now is people are very deeply in debt. And there's a basic economic principle, debts that can't be paid won't be. The question is, how aren't they going to be paid? People with student loans can't go bankrupt, so the government or collection agencies are going to go after whatever property they have. They're going to dock their salary. And we're basically moving into a period where all of people's revenue, just over and above basic needs, is going to pay the bankers. Now, many people who are in this position are feeling very bad. They're feeling very depressed. And the tendency is to blame themselves. And what I've seen in the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York is very much what's occurred not only in Greece, but also in the Arab Spring. All people are coming together, and at first people may simply walk, onlookers may go by to see what it's all about. But then they think, wait a minute, other people are having the same problem I'm having. It's not really my fault. And they're beginning to say, wait, if all these people have the same problem of not paying the debt, and of being sort of crippled by the banks, then it's not that I've done something wrong in my life. It's that there's really something wrong with the system. Now, this makes them feel gradually there's a lot of peer pressure, and they feel stronger and stronger. And 50 years ago, an old revolutionary strategist told me that revolutions happen when people get tired of being afraid. And in this case, the revolution may happen when people get tired just of being depressed and stop blaming themselves and thinking, if we're all in this together, then it must be that something's wrong with the way the economy is organized. And what's basically wrong is that the financial system is running the government. And for years, the Republicans and the Democrats have said, well, to regulate and to have a strong government is a road to serfdom. And they said, let's take planning out of the hands of government and put it in the hands of the banks. And the problem is, when you do that, then you're on the road to debt peonage. And that's even worse than government planning. And they've then essentially taken the Federal Reserve and the Treasury that are supposed to work on behalf of the population at large, and they've put financial lobbyists in charge, Tim Geithner and the other people, all of whom have ties to Reaganomics from the Clinton administration or to Goldman Sachs and others. So the first thing to realize is something that is a characteristic of all of the big reform movements. They're not necessarily yet going to a radical opposition of saying, look, we have to restructure the whole system. Small marginal reforms won't work. But what they say is, we're trying to restore the way it was, and simply restoring the criminal justice system, which has been stopped. Simply restoring the tax system. It used to be that the rich pay taxes. Now they don't. It used to be that if you're a fraud, if you cheated people, if you lied on your income tax, if you lied on statistics, you'd be sent to jail. The Obama administration has appointed Eric Holder as a bank lobbyist who's promised not to throw any Wall Street crook in jail because they are the campaign contributors for the Democratic Party. And I think certainly in New York, what I sensed from the people there was an anger not only at economics, but the fact that the political system is broken, that there's no one to vote for as an alternative, because you have what nobody expected, Mr. Obama coming out and moving to the right of the Republicans, coming out with an even more anti-Social Security, anti-Medicaid, anti-black, and anti-minority position than any Republican would dare do, because if a Republican would have done what Obama did, the Democratic Congress would have refused to pass it. But they don't know how to deal with the fact that here you have a Democratic president that is really put in as a lobbyist for the man who he approached when he joined the Senate and said, I want you to be my mentor. You're my hero. And that man was Joe Lieberman, who became Obama's mentor and showed him how to suck up to the financial classes. And we have someone who is simply a nightmare. And I think the people so far, certainly in New York, are saying we're not going to let the Democrats try to jump in front of our parade and simply make this supporting a Democratic Party to screw us even more. They realize that if the financial system is broken and you don't have either party able to do anything about it, then the political system has to be changed as well. Not only the fact that Goldman Sachs gets to win at the auction the right to say who's going to be the Treasury Secretary, someone like Geithner, who just gives them a lot of money, but the whole down the line, the fact that in the Democratic Congress, every committee chairman has to pay to the party $150,000 to buy the committee chairmanship. That's the rule, and that means that the campaign donors get to determine who gets the committee chairmanship throughout all of Congress, and the whole system is geared towards basically screwing the protesters. So once they once the protesters realize that they're all being screwed, that's a pre-revolutionary situation. That's a situation where they can then come and you get a lot of support precisely by not doing what the New York Times and the other papers said all you have to do. You have to come up with a solution. They don't have to come up with a solution because right now there isn't a solution on the horizon. There's no way to clean up the mess that's the Democratic Party in Wall Street's pocket, or the Republican Party in Wall Street's pocket. There's no solution within the existing system, and that is the longer that they can simply diagnose the problem and explain what the problem is and share the feelings that everybody has of being victimized, then you're creating a raw material that's going to be able to flower into a political activism probably by spring or this time next year.
Well, let me ask you this, and of course it's somewhat of a intellectual speculative game, but let's say that it's now January 2013, and radical progressive candidate X, Dennis Kucinich or Bernie Sanders, is miraculously elected president. Michael Hudson is the chief economic advisor. What would you do, given the opportunity with a favorable Congress, to transform the American economy in ways that would produce policies that you think would at least start to help to break the grip that the financial industries have in just absolutely devastating the economy in terms of its performance for average households?
There are two stages to any kind of a transformation. The first stage is simply to begin reapplying the laws and the taxes that has been that nobody has been applying. The first thing to do, of course, would be to get rid of the crooks who are in charge, like Geithner, and the lobbyists. You don't want Wall Street to be able to put a lobbyist in charge of making policy. The second thing is, I guess only a president could do it. You invite the Supreme Court members into your office and you say, please don't take this personally, but because of the lifetime membership, I've got to take you into the next room and shoot you. Unless, of course, you want to simply resign. So you get their resignations. You give them an offer they can't refuse. And then you appoint Supreme Court people that are not radicals and that will reverse the citizens the ruling that says corporations can give all are the same as people, and in fact have even more rights than people. You essentially clean up the corruption of the legal system that has led to the crooks not being sent to jail, and essentially decriminalized financial fraud. You then set up a banking system, and there are a number of proposals for this. You set up a public option for banking so that instead of being reliant on Bank of America or Citibank for credit cards, the government is going to run a bank and a credit card at cost. And the idea, all throughout the 19th century, the idea was that a public option, and at that time it was a post office bank, would provide banking at cost or at a subsidized price, just for the same reason that a government would provide free roads. You want to lower the cost of doing business. So by providing a public option, essentially, you would push the push the existing banks out of business unless they acted like the old savings banks and SNLs did. In fact, at the most radical, what I would want to do is the Chicago plan, which was promoted in the 1930s. Essentially, you take away the bank's right to create credit and you make them do what the textbook says banks are supposed to do. They take deposits and they lend them out. And because there are not enough deposits in the economy, the government would create money, the Treasury would create the money, supply it to the banks to lend out, but you'd rewrite the banking laws so that they're not able to gamble. You reinstate the Glass-Steagall Act so that they can't gamble. You reestablish productive lending so that banks will lend for actual capital formation, not simply bid up the price of assets from real estate or stocks and bonds. In terms of the tax laws, I would get rid of the tax deductibility of interest. Right now, the tax system promotes debt financing. You want to lower the debt overhead. You don't want to encourage debt leveraging. I would also tax capital gains either at the full rate of income tax or even higher rate. I would close down the offshore banking centers and treat any deposit by an American in an offshore banking center as earned income and tax it at a 90% rate. You'd restore the rates of the Eisenhower administration when the country had the most rapid growth that it had. You would reinstate criminal penalties for financial fraud and attempts to evade the spirit of the law by tax evasion, by misrepresentation. But if you really wanted to get radical, you would do what is going to be inevitable for every economy. And it's what the Allies did to the German economy in 1947 to create its economic miracle. You have to cancel the bad debts that have taken place. This can be done either by an across-the-board clean slate, or it could be by applying across the country what has been on the New York state law since before the Revolution, when New York was still a colony. And that's the law of fraudulent conveyance. And the law of fraudulent conveyance says that if a creditor makes a loan to a borrower without having any idea how the borrower can pay in the normal course of business without losing their property, then the loan is deemed fraudulent and is null and void. This would free most of the property that's in negative equity throughout the country. And the aim of all of this, of course, when you cancel a debt, you cancel people's savings. But you're in a position now where the richest 1% of America have doubled its share of the returns to wealth in the last 25 years. And that's inequitable. You want to reverse that. And you reverse that by reinstating progressive taxation, basically, and shifting the tax system so that collect predatory income or unearned income or what the classical economists called economic rent. You favor wages and business profits, but not simply extractive rent-seeking.
And I have one final question for you, and that is, would you support programs that are put forward similar to what Randy Ray, an associate of yours, suggests in terms of government employment projects to guarantee full employment?
Yes, as long as they're not military. I think Randy and I are in agreement with that. Of course the government should do that. The problem is that Wall Street now says, that's a great idea. Let the government pay for infrastructure and then spend $1 billion on a bridge and then sell it to us for a dollar and make us even richer. You want to do it in a way that the crooks that are sponsored by the Republicans and the Democrats are not going to be able to turn around and privatize this at a giveaway price and suddenly install a toll booth on the bridge and get a free right to turn America into a toll booth economy. So, yes, I'm all in favor of that as long as you have safeguards against the financial fraud that's being sponsored by the current administration.
Michael Hudson, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on KPFK.
Thanks a lot, Alan.
Welcome back to Building a Powerful Movement in the United States. This is KPFK's Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by a former KPFK producer, Melisa Figueroa. Melisa Figueroa is currently a graduate student in the Geography Department at the University of California, Berkeley, and she has she resides in Oakland, and she has been very involved in the development of Occupy Oakland. Welcome to KPFK, Melisa Figueroa.
Thanks, Alan.
So tell us your impressions about yesterday, and in particular, your sense of citywide solidarity with the general strike that occurred yesterday.
Okay, I joined the action at around 1 p.m., and we marched. I was with a contingent of Berkeley students, and the first march in the afternoon was advertised as an anti-capitalist march. There was probably about close to 1,000 people who marched through the streets of Oakland in the afternoon, and, you know, I could get better a sense of how the city, at least the people around there, viewed the Occupy movement. As we went through the streets, there were cars that were stopped. Many of them were honking and very supportive. Other people who were working were in their windows of their offices and waving and showing their support as well. It was generally extremely positive. From that, I think I could say that, at least from what I saw in the afternoon, that the support for the Occupy movement was overwhelmingly positive. There were a few confrontations, but it was very, very isolated. So I would say that it was overwhelmingly positive.
Now, I spoke to you when you arrived out at the port yesterday, and you were astonished. You said you had never been involved in anything that was both as radically powerful as what you were participating in and also as uplifting.
Yeah, I think the closest that I felt from the feeling that I had yesterday was probably during the February 15, 2003 protests against the war. Just the sense of sheer people power was just overwhelming. There's a freeway overpass that you have to pass through to get to the port entrance. And so I was with the first march that left Oscar Grant Plaza at 4 p.m., and as we approached this overpass, you could kind of see the sheer crowd of people going over the overpass and into the port entrance. And when everybody in my section saw that mass of people, everybody was just overcome by emotion, and the cheers and the crowd was just overwhelming. You know, we really had a sense that, you know, we're going to do this. We're going to shut down the port. A lot of the media reports are saying that there are maybe 3,000 to 5,000 people. That is a gross underestimate of how many people were there, just so that people know that it wasn't just a few thousand. It was tens of thousands. We were probably 5,000 in the first march that got to the port. The second march was orders of magnitude larger. We were also on top of a shipping container when the second march came in, and the feeling of these people joining together was just incredible. And for many people who had never been to, you know, a kind of political march before, it was just and seeing their enthusiasm and their sense of power and the way that, you know, they sort of discovered what people power really felt like was just an amazing feeling.
Oakland is an incredibly diverse city. How diverse was the crowd yesterday, both in terms of, you know, as far as you could discern, people's occupations, people's economic class status, and ethnic diversity as well, and age?
I think that there were a lot of young people, but the participation of the unions brought out a lot of people, very diverse spectrum of the working class as well. I saw various contingents that spoke to very many issues, including immigrants' rights, including people of color, and various other things that spoke to the diversity of both the Oakland community and of the diversity of the march itself. So I think that what was represented was a very broad spectrum that reflected the diversity of the community, and also there are a lot of communities that also, for various reasons, felt like they could not participate, including undocumented workers and people who are incarcerated or have been through the system as well. But at least from what I heard from other organizers that were working with that they were in solidarity, even though they could not bodily be at the port.
And so you would say that the city of Oakland, with its proud working class heritage, at least with the exclusion of, say, the McMansions in the hills of Oakland, with its proud working class tradition, they are embracing the general message of the movement that the U.S. economy has been serving the 1%, not the 99%, and that the country, politically and economically, is just off the tracks, and it's going to take people power to get it back.
Oh, I think so. I think so. I think what I see operating in Occupy Oakland is very much an embracing and a recognition of its history, including the fact that the last general strike in the United States happened in 1946 in Oakland itself. So I do think that there's both a sense of history, a sense of continuity with the community organizing that's been going on continuously, from the Black Panthers to the Oscar Grant movement to now Occupy Oakland, and including, you know, various other movements that have been active in the community as well. Again, I've only been up here a couple of months, but my education as far as Oakland's history of economic fighting for economic justice has accelerated definitely in the time that I've been here. So.
And finally, at the end of the night, late at night, actually in the evening, some people went into a previously unoccupied building, and this was in harmony, at least, with a motion that was passed at the Oakland General Assembly a couple days ago about taking unused property and putting it to use, since so many people need the use of buildings that are just latent, as it were, not being utilized. And then later in the night, the Alameda County Sheriff's Department showed up and tried to evict them. Just quickly, in about a minute's time, your reflections on this, and you know, the degree to which the media has focused on this, your sense of this, its insignificance relative to the general happenings of the day, but then also what you make of it and how it may impact the movement going forward.
Okay, in terms of the idea of reclaiming abandoned spaces for the uses of the community, was something that I absolutely support. And when the motion was brought up at the GA, you know, I had expressed my support for this proposal as well. The building that was taken over, there was a flyer that was being passed out, was the former home of the Oakland Travelers Aid Society, which apparently was a nonprofit that had served the needs of the community, including the homeless population. It was closed down due to cut funding, and the property was abandoned. And so the idea, according to the flyer, was to take over that space and reclaim it as a both educational and community a resource for the community. That I was completely in support from. As to what happened during the police confrontation, I had already gone home by the time that that had happened. I do think that it's very unfortunate that the media has chosen to focus on the actions of a few, and you know, a very sort of small portion of the day's events, instead of the incredible people power that the majority of the people participated in. At the same time, I do believe that the reclamation of spaces is something that needs to happen, because the economic crisis has left so many empty spaces and so many parts of the community unserved, while the 1% continues to accumulate all the profits at the expense of the people. So I hope that going forward, that the movement continues to grow outside the encampments and the occupations and into the community in this manner, but also recognizing that the state is more interested in protecting property than the community, at least in the way that the orders are coming down. And that resistance is to be expected from the police and the state.
Melisa Figueroa, and thank you so much for joining us here on KPFK. Melisa Figueroa, former KPFK producer, currently a graduate student at UC Berkeley, and perhaps now our roving reporter up in Oakland for the Occupy Oakland movement. Thank you for joining us on KPFK's Building a Powerful Movement in the United States.
Thank you.
And now to an excerpt from a longer conversation that I had with Clark Davis from Occupy Los Angeles, in which Clark, I believe, captures what has motivated so many people across the country and the world to participate in the Occupy movement.
in myself, the frustration, the level of frustration was overwhelming. In a lot of the people that I've been talking to over the last year or so, I was hearing the same story over and over and over again. And that was, in a sense, our economy, our country has been basically hijacked.
Right.
And some people aren't able to express that very clearly, and other people are. But I would say, you know, 80 to 90% of the people that I've been talking to, and I've been very vocal about these issues over the last couple of years, basically were so disturbed about our system that they even had a difficult time talking about it because it was so overwhelming and so frustrating right. and so angering that even getting it out in a clear and concise fashion is challenging to do. It's like they're almost just speechless, like, what has happened here? So I would say without a doubt that these feelings of discontent and disgust, I think, are indeed pervasive all the way across the board, even over to the Tea Party and the right, because at this point in time, I think it is undeniable at every level that our system of governance has been completely corrupted, is providing literally for no, or almost literally for no one other than the people at the top, and that it's gotten to a place where we are now just, in a sense, a slave to the system, you know, a number, that we've lost our dignity, we've lost our voice, we've lost our vote, we've lost our capacity to be really productive citizens.
The voice of Clark Davis from Occupy Los Angeles. That's our show for today. This has been Building a Powerful Movement in the United States. I'm your host and producer, Alan Minsky. I want to thank Clark Davis from Occupy Los Angeles, Melisa Figueroa from up in Oakland, California, Michael Hudson, who spoke to us from Berlin, Germany, and Chris Hedges, who a reporter ran into in Times Square, New York City. Tune in again tomorrow for more Building a Powerful Movement in the United States.